I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about consumer cyber safety. How many of you have shopped online or communicated financial or personal information? Most likely quite a few of us have. Today we're going to talk about ways to do so safely. We'll identify risks and come up with strategies for avoiding or minimizing those risks. My guests today are Indiana State Police Lieutenant Chuck Cohen, Scott McElwain of Cadre Information Security, and Evan Thomas of the National Bank of Indianapolis. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, Executive Editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about consumer cybersecurity, and I'm fortunate to have as my guest today Indiana State Police Lieutenant Chuck Cohen. Lieutenant Cohen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
It's good to have you here. Scott McElwain of Cadre Information Security. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Evan Thomas of the National Bank of Indianapolis. Evan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's good to have you all here. Well, and I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation. You can call us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'm going to start first by just asking, how big a problem is this? I mean, how secure or threatened should people feel if they're on the web a lot, and you know, particularly if they're transacting any kind of business there? I'll start with you, Lieutenant Cohen.
I think by any measure, if you're talking about cybercrime in general, it is a huge problem and a growing problem. For example, the Indiana State Police received well over 1,000 complaints from the Internet Crime Complaints Center, which is a national clearinghouse, just in 2011 alone, just involving either victims in Indiana, suspects in Indiana, or where they're both living in Indiana. But if you look at cybercrime in general, like I said, it is a huge problem and growing. It's an overwhelming problem, but it's one that really well can be mitigated by users, can be controlled by users if they follow some very simple safety steps, some of the things we're going to talk about today.
And when you say there are 1,000. What? How do we define cybercrime? Might be a good way to work it in terms of the criminal code. And I'm assuming as state police lieutenant, you would be the guy to ask that question.
Well, that's one of the things. Different people define cybercrime differently. Mm-hmm. It can range all the way from online child enticement to complex fraud being involved where computers are involved, to schemes that are being conducted to try to fund terrorist activities. So one of the challenges when you ask people how they define it, if you ask 10 people in law enforcement, 10 people in the judiciary, you're going to get 10 different definitions of cybercrime and what the implications are. And again, it ranges from very complex schemes that are done in international nature to something done by a 12 or 13-year-old that might be your next-door neighbor.
And I'm presuming, obviously, in part because it's a even though it now is all pervasive in our lives, this technology is still a relatively recent development. I mean, we're only talking about past 15 to 20 years that it's exploded. Has that been part of the problem, is that the law has been a little bit slow in catching up with the crimes? I don't mean law enforcement officials, but just the idea of defining what a cybercrime would be.
Well, that is one of the things. Technology evolves very quickly, and legislation does not always evolve quite as quickly. But whatever technology comes along, the technology itself, in my personal opinion, it's never bad or evil. A technology isn't. But criminals will find a way to exploit whatever technology comes along to the criminal purpose, whatever that purpose might happen to be.
And how I'm going to switch the conversation here to Scott McElwain of Cadre Information Security. Scott, how large a problem is it? Obviously, you approach it from a slightly different perspective of, rather than investigating the crime, you're trying to prevent it from happening in the first place.
Right.
How big a problem and how big a challenge has it been in your end of the business?
Well, I know a word you used just a moment ago was pervasive. Technology has become pervasive in our lives, so the opportunity for criminals to take advantage of that has I think growing at the same rate. One of the companies we work with, I was just looking at some figures, and they claimed that the last quarter they had the largest fines. They research malware, bad things going on in the computing world, and they had the most they've ever found in the last quarter. So it continues to grow as this pervasiveness grows. And in the past, in the distant past of 5 to maybe 7, 8 years ago in the IT world, you saw a lot more of people hacking things more for enjoyment almost. There was clubs that did it. I worked with a small company out in the west part of Indiana that got hacked by Italian teenagers, and all they did was put banner pages up on their network and to show that they had been there. That has really changed in the last few years to it being very much a money-making venture for the people doing it. It's being done all over the world, of course. And fighting it is a constant battle to stay ahead of the people. You mentioned the legislation, how that's is struggles with keeping up as well. So it's an ever-growing problem that the solutions for it, people need to be always trying to keep up with it and update their systems and such, and we can talk more about that too.
Yeah, we are going to talk about how to avoid and all of that. How big a problem is it in the banking industry right now, Evan, Thomas?
It's a big problem from a reputation risk standpoint. I don't think there's any real concern that the actual financial services industry, your banking applications are at risk. The real risk are the devices that you use to access those applications. So, I'm old enough to remember when they first rolled out ATMs, and we had an issue, this is a long time ago, where people were writing their ATM pins on the back of their card. You lose your wallet. Someone has your ATM card. They have your ATM pin. They can get all your money. Well, depending on your behavior on your computer, on your smartphone device, you may be leaving your pin out there. There's nothing wrong with that ATM then. There's nothing wrong necessarily with the financial services systems now. It's the behavior around those that causes us concern.
We are talking about consumer cybersecurity here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, I want to talk a little bit, and I'll start with Scott on this one. Where are the biggest threats coming from right now? What are the things people should be the most worried about?
I think some of the big things that people can make sure that they can reduce the chance of them being a victim of cybercrime is, for one, installing and using some one of the well-known security softwares, and then more importantly, keeping it up to date. People tend to not update things, and they see these notes come about, well, Adobe Flash or Adobe needs to be upgraded, I'll do that later. There's actual real threats that those updates are designed to prevent from happening to you. So that's a big one.
What sort of threats, if I might?
Well, things like malware being loaded onto your computer. There's things that are injected into documents that can come from, say, an Adobe that then could set up and install what's called, generally called like a botnet to run in your in the background of your computer and steal your passwords, those kinds of things.
Well, and I probably should ask real quickly, since part of what I get paid for here is to ask the stupid question or whatever, the one that other people would be too embarrassed to ask. Could you define malware real quickly? I know we can fall into terminology here, something that...
Right, and I think there's a lot of different definitions for it. The main thing is it's something that's running on your computer that's designed to do harm to you or your security that you don't want to have running on that computer. It can be a really wide range of things, though, but it's the wrong stuff running on your your computer, your network.
And Evan Thomas, what do you think the big threats are?
I think he's got it exactly right. It's malware, which is malicious software. So the common example that bothers banking customers is you may have bought a new machine, it came with antivirus software, maybe you didn't pay the $19 or $49 to update it. A year later, you think your machine's still safe, and some of this malware has been installed by you just clicking on a link on a reasonably safe-looking site. And now then, some bad guy, maybe in Estonia or Georgia or South Central Indiana, can see everything that's going on your computer. So when you type in your password, whether it's into Apple iTunes or to your bank or to your airline, they can see what you've typed and perhaps take over your account and do you financial harm.
Now, are there protections built in so that if somebody does that and, let's say, captures my personal information and accesses my bank account, how much of that am I responsible for?
With most financial institutions, you are responsible for good, safe behavior. So theoretically, you could be very responsible.
Wiped out, Chuck Cohen, Lieutenant Chuck Cohen.
Well, we asked what some of the biggest risks are, and from what we see, a lot of times the biggest risk is the behavior of the victim themselves. You mentioned having responsible and doing things responsibly. Just simple things like making sure that your home wireless router, that's your home network, making sure that it has a password on it, meaning that it's encrypted. Mm-hmm. Doing simple things like making sure that the SSID or the name it broadcasts to the world is not the default one out of the box, making yourself look like a easy prey to a potential person that is going to try to get access. Doing simple things like changing your password so that you don't have the same password for your social media that you have for your banking, so that if one gets exploited by someone, they don't get access to all corners of your personal, financial, and business life. So from an investigative perspective, oftentimes what we see when someone is a victim, yes, one of the biggest threat is sometimes the biggest threat and what exposes them to being victimized is essentially, unfortunately, their own behaviors that led up to that.
And let me stay with you for a second, Lieutenant Chuck Cohen of the Indiana State Police. In what areas, you mentioned earlier that there were 1,000 incidents reported in 2011. Is there any overwhelming, majority of those that concern one kind of crime? Is it generally people trying to take financial advantage of, in some way, or access personal information, or what other ways?
By and large, the two largest areas we see is those that are trying to exploit children online and wanting to do this for financial gain. But one of the big trends we're seeing is when they're trying to get information on someone, more so than ever before, they're going out and trying to find the information that person put about themselves up and online. The hackers, the bad guys, call it doxing, D-O-X-I-N-G. Investigators call it open source intelligence, but by either name, what it is going out and seeing what you put up on your Twitter stream, on Facebook, on all the other social media aspects, and then using that to exploit you and get access to more of your personal information.
So what should you do? Like, we'll start with, say, Facebook. What things should you not post on Facebook then?
You shouldn't put anything up on Facebook that you wouldn't want to be able to show to absolutely everybody else in your neighborhood, everyone else in your city. You should go through Facebook, as an example, and look at the privacy settings and see exactly what footprint you're putting out there, what information you're putting out for the rest of the world and everyone else to see. Basically, you need to understand that many of the same security questions, those challenge questions that your bank or some other institution, your credit card company, are going to ask you to verify it's you, oftentimes with the exact same information that people put up on social media telling people about themselves. So I can guess pretty easily what questions would be asked if I want to impersonate you and where I can find the answers to those questions.
So I shouldn't list what, I think one of the questions, security questions that some financial institution asks is what month of the year my father was born in. I should not put that anywhere out there that could be connected. Now, that gets a little trickier because let's assume for the moment that my father is a Facebook friend of mine and he lists his birth date. I can't necessarily control that, right?
Absolutely, but you also don't have to tell that bank that asked the challenge question the truth. What I mean is you can answer the question any way you want as long as you remember what that answer is later if you have to get your password reset.
Oh, okay. Well, that means, though, I've got to keep track of all of that stuff. The truth sort of simplifies those of us who have bad memories. In a dollar figure, roughly how much is at risk here? I mean, when you say there are 1,000 incidents in the state, how much, and one of the big areas of child security is one of them, but the other one is child safety. But the other one was that people trying to take financial advantage. How much money have they pilfered?
The National White Collar Crime Center puts that figure in the tens of billions of dollars.
Tens of billions of
yes.
dollars? Does that jibe with what you've seen, Evan Thomas?
Yeah, I think what you see mostly is individual consumers aren't being targeted. Large businesses are being targeted. I may only have $200 in my checking account. It's probably not worth some, organized crime cartel to come after me. But if I own a business and I've got, many millions of dollars in deposits somewhere and 15 employees and I've got one of them behaving irresponsibly and exposing the business to these threats we're talking about, then we could become one of the lieutenant statistics from a large loss standpoint. And that's basically limited to however that business chooses to operate online.
We are talking about consumer cybersecurity here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. My guests today are Indiana State Police Lieutenant Chuck Cohen, Scott McElwain of Cadre Information Security, and Evan Thomas of the National Bank of Indianapolis. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about consumer cybersecurity here on No Limits. My guests are Indiana State Police Lieutenant Chuck Cohen, Scott McElwain of Cadre Information Security. That's a tough one to roll right off the tongue. And Evan Thomas of the National Bank of Indianapolis. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, we've talked a little bit about how primarily financial institutions are the things that are targets more. Evan Thomas was making that point right before we took the break. I guess what I'd like to start is the profile of the people that we need to be frightened of changed over time. And I'm going to go to Scott McElwain. You sort of alluded to this earlier in the program when you said originally it might be a group of kids who were kind of hacker clubs now, but it sounds like we've moved to a stage where this is much more organized, much more big business approach to the threat. It's not a hobby anymore. It's a business.
Right. It's, you can't make a living in the honest way. You go out and you figure out a way to do it dishonestly. And I know one recent example is, Apple computers, Macintosh, are generally considered to be more secure and less threatened by malware and by hackers. But there was a recent breach that was discovered where they believe the hackers were actually getting up to $10,000 a day by stealing Google advertising money is the way it was working. They were hijacking if you clicked on a Google ad, instead of going to the legitimate Google getting credit for that, it was going to these hackers, and that was in the Mac world. So the financial side of it, the growth of that, the way that the money that people can make doing it, the false virus alerts you have maybe seen on your computer where it says, oh, you've got a virus, please send us $39.95 or $49.95, and we'll solve that problem for you. And obviously you never had the virus you had is what popped up, not something else. Those kinds of things have just become much more prevalent.
We've got a question that's kind of on point here. A question from a listener who says, with more people using iDevices, are there new concerns about viruses in the Apple operating environment? Scott, I'll stay with you since you alluded to it first.
Anything that's becoming more and more prevalent, more used by users is going to become a target if it's not already. One of the things, the iPhone, the way that they sell their applications, the way that you get applications for your iPhone or iPad is more secure, generally is perceived more secure in the market because they have to go through the Apple store to do that, whereas the other big competitor nowadays is the Android market, and that's much more of an open by design market, and so therefore there are more threats there. But anything that's used, the more it's out in the world, the more likely it will be attacked. I think that's the simple fact. Macs still represent a relatively small percent of overall use. I believe people quote in the 10% range. But so therefore, if you're going to attack people and want to write bad things to make money for yourself, are you going to go for 10% or 90% of the market is the way that it's looked at, or generally people think that it's looked at. But certainly I see more and more people are talking more and more about the threats to the iWorld, the Mac world, the Apple world. It's growing.
We are talking about consumer cybersecurity here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten another email question from a listener named Jim who says, what app is best to protect data on my smartphone? Is there an app that that one would recommend? Evan Thomas.
I don't know that I would recommend an app as much as a behavior, which is when you're downloading apps in general, think about what you're downloading. Just, you know, don't download anything because it's the newest thing on the marketplace. And everyone's got Angry Birds. We're all pretty sure Angry Birds is pretty safe. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking about a brand new game, a brand new app, doesn't have any ratings in the marketplace, we really don't know yet if that's a safe provider. So by downloading that app, you may be exposing yourself, even though it has nothing to do with financial services or security.
Well, and one would think that they might try to sneak something in through that pathway. I guess that raises another question, though. I mean, if, in this case, if you're thinking about downloading an app, I mean, presumably somebody's got to be the first, right, to do all of this. Are there places you can go to check the security of the application? Chuck Cohen,
well, I think
Indiana
one thing
State,
you
please.
Well, I think one thing you might want to do is look at the App Store and see how many people have downloaded it. Someone has to be first. That first person doesn't have to be you, though. It's something called crowdsourcing. Watch to see how other people have reacted. Is the app stable? Does it work properly? And the thing is, unlike traditional software for a laptop or desktop, where it's going to be large corporations, many of them are U.S. corporations we're familiar with, like Adobe, like Microsoft, like Apple, anyone can design an app, and the person that designed that app might be doing that out of their basement, their mother's basement, might be in the United States, might be on a different continent. So until it's a trusted app, until you know all the functionality of it, and most of your listeners have probably downloaded an app and found that app has asked for location information, as an example, but they may have noticed that sometimes those apps don't need that location information to operate properly, to function for what they're supposed to do. So the question has to be, where is that information going? Why do they want to collect that information?
Should that be a warning sign if it asks for that? Something that I see Evan Thomas is shaking his head back and forth. Evan, yes and no, I'm assuming, is the universal gesture there. What are the reasons that you might be concerned about it and then reasons that you might not be?
So if you have an app, let's say it's a music app, let's say it's there's no functionality based on where you're physically at on the planet, I would wonder why they want that access. If you have a coffee shop app, and part of the function of that app is to tell you how quickly you can get your next fix on a coffee cup, that's perfectly reasonable. So, I mean, it really is based on the circumstances. Can you make a case that whatever information they're asking for is needed, you know, to give you the full function of the program they've sold you?
Yes, Lieutenant Cohen.
And we've also been talking about the technical exploitations or technical cybercrime. Cybercrime can also be something as simple as now everyone carries around a tablet device, mm-hmm, or a mobile phone. So if they lose that, if it gets stolen, for most people that means that their home address information is going to be located inside there. For many people, if they've got apps that go to banking or financial information, if they don't take the safeguards of logging in every time, leave themselves logged into, as an example, their social media application, that's going to give that person basically the keys to the kingdom to find out about you and to victimize you if that gets stolen or lost.
We are talking about consumer cybersecurity here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Gideon, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Certainly. Your question, please.
Which is safer? Is it my cell phone or laptop or my desktop when I want to check my bank account?
Good question. Thank you very much for the call. I'll start first with Evan Thomas on that as the banker on the panel, and then go to Scott McElwain.
With most financial institutions, you're actually accessing the same system, whether you're going through your phone, your laptop, or your desktop. So I suspect the answer is really, which one of those things do you keep the cleanest? Now, if you have one of those iDevices we were talking about where it's a very controlled environment, you can't download some of that scary stuff, that might be the safest place. If it's your work laptop and you don't download anything and you keep that crystal clear because you only want work on it, that's probably a really safe place to do your banking. If it's your kid's computer, your kid might be between 11 and 19, I might avoid that one.
Scott McElwain.
Yeah, I would echo what Evan said for sure, that it really depends on the device, what kind of security protection you have on each device, you know, how up to date it is. All those things are important, but obviously the one that you've got the cleanest, is in his word, is the one you probably want to do that the most on. There's products for keeping those things up to date, and it can identify when you need to do updates. And you know, the question is whether you do them and keep it up to date. Security is only as good as what you are willing to work at to keep it functional and operational. And again, up to date is the word that we our internal people beat on us, and we're in the security business, that we need to make sure that we have everything updated on our software continually. Get notices all the time about have you done the latest update for this software or that, and so your device is important, but it's is it updated, I think, is the ultimate decider.
Is there a good rule of thumb as to how you should do that just as a person at home? I mean, how often should you update? Or is there a quick and easy way for you to check? You mentioned that there are ways to, to check and see if your computer is updated. Evan Thomas.
Most software now allows you to do automatic updating, and there's no reason not to do it. Just let the computer update itself. I think most people leave their computers on. Your computer's on, it'll update it. You don't have to worry about it. You do have to worry about paying for an antivirus subscription on a PC or a laptop or maybe a Mac these days. But beyond that, just let it do it itself.
We have gotten a tweet question that says, in terms of Internet browsers, is there a better choice? Mozilla, Internet Explorer, Safari, Google Chrome? Lieutenant Cohen, Chuck Cohen.
Well, the major Internet browsers, Internet Explorer, Firefox, Opera, Chrome, and Safari for Macintosh, everyone's got their favorite. I particularly like to use Firefox for no other reason than it's open source, meaning people are routinely updating it, making improvements to it over time. And also, I use it a lot for criminal investigations, because many of the add-ons for it I can use forensically for criminal investigations.
Such as
ones to tell when you're going to go over a hyperlink or you're going to go someplace, where it's at, what the IP address is for it, a bunch of technical things to trace route that, and who is, a bunch of things you listeners probably don't care about so much, things to try to identify images and where that image might also be located on the Internet. So different things when we're doing those investigations on that involve the Internet, to have those ready tools available. But I would guess if you asked all three of us would probably individually have a favorite they like to use. Oftentimes that's because that's the what the person is most comfortable using.
Is there any, in terms of standardized stuff, though, is any one of them safer than the other? Scott McElwain?
Saying the same thing over, but I think it would come down to which one have you kept up to date. If you keep them, those major names, the Internet Explorer, the Mozilla Firefox, Opera's another one. Chrome is, I believe, has become one of the most commonly used, and maybe has become number one very recently. They're all focusing on security, and the key is, again, keeping it up to date and making sure that you've got the latest version running. And you're not running, five versions old, and you've just not updated, because that's where you're going to get hurt. That's where they've discovered vulnerabilities, and somebody's going to try to exploit that on you.
And generally, when they do the updates, is it for security reasons? Evan Thomas.
Largely. I mean, there are a few updates that are just what we've come to expect as Internet users. We want this to be faster. We want this to look a certain way. But mostly it's, we found that this bad guy got in through this hole, so we have to patch that hole. I would agree with the other gentleman. I think the best browser is the newest one. Whichever one has been most recently updated is the one to go with.
And gotten a question. Should people avoid clicking on the flashing ads, the things that pop up? Are those particularly dangerous, Lieutenant Cohen?
I personally do avoid clicking on those. If I haven't chosen to go to a particular site, if I haven't asked for a solicitation from somebody, I'm not going to click on that. And one of the things that the other gentleman mentioned, talking about those fake, your computer's infected advertisements, that's one of the very insidious ways that people actually get access to your computer. But we generally refer to it as phishing or farming with a PH. Mm-hmm. If people didn't fall for it, we wouldn't still be getting the schemes of someone's found money that you have $10 million waiting for you in a Canadian lottery or waiting from some inheritance in Nigeria. If you get those, one thing you can know as you're deleting it is somebody else inevitably has fallen for that scam, or they wouldn't keep sending those.
We are talking about consumer cybersecurity here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, let's take this a step back here, because some of this, I think, are people, the people who've been listening, and we've directed the show and the conversation towards so far, are reasonably sophisticated. Let's start with somebody who literally would know nothing about this. In the things that you do, let's assume you've just bought a computer, brought it home, senior citizen, say, who's not necessarily spent most of their lives not part of the digital age, and you're unpacking the thing and you want to go online. What things should you do? What things shouldn't you do? Lieutenant Cohen.
I think if we're talking about some simple things, everyone in the world, from children to seniors now, have passwords, have PIN numbers. Have it be something that is not easily guessed, not easily guessed by someone else, something that's not in the dictionary even. And again, like I said earlier in the show, don't have the same password or the same PIN number for everything that you do in the digital world. Because what it means is if one person can guess or finds out your password or PIN number for one of the things you do, they essentially can get access to all of those things that you do. So I think it's simple things like that. Don't set your PIN the same as you do for your garage opener at your house. No security system, whether that is a deadbolt on a house or the most sophisticated one for a computer, is fail-safe. But you want to make yourself as hard a target, as difficult a target as humanly possible. For most people, I can guess within probably 10 guesses most of their passwords. It's going to be something like the address for the house, their date of birth, one of their children's names. It's going to be something that they can easily remember, possibly their anniversary if they're married, or one of their children's significant events in their lives. So most people tend to do that. There actually was an exploitation where a large site got hacked into, so they know what the passwords are. The most common passwords are 123456 and password.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And those were from sophisticated people.
Yeah, what's the point of having a password at that case? So making sure that you've got things set up with PINs and all of that, are there other obvious or easily avoidable mistakes that people make? Scott McElwain.
I think one of the things is downloading free software is a big issue. Usually that's, you get what you pay for. And if it's free, you're probably going to be getting something that's more than what you're paying for there. Another big one that we keep talking about it, but you cannot assume that your security software is going to totally protect you. You've got to use common sense. And of course, the next question is how common is that common sense? But, don't assume that just because you've got some security software running, which most people do nowadays, that you're automatically protected. We talked about this one too, accessing an account through an email link. If you get emailed something and it says, oh, you need to go to this link to update your bank software, well, that's probably not the way the bank, it's not the way the bank's going to be contacting you.
Evan Thomas
his head,
is, yes,
agreeing
Evan
with
Thomas.
Me.
So
but,
I'll give you
so
the,
you,
the last word on
yeah,
that
so
one.
You, yeah, so you... if you think that's something you need to do, go to the actual website of the bank and log in the way you normally do, but don't use that link to get there. We talked about this one, the single password for all accounts. Use different passwords, use complicated passwords. I know it's more challenging. There are things you can get for your smartphones that'll keep track of your passwords that are secure, and you can keep track of all these different passwords you seem to end up with, and I know we all struggle with that. I think a lot of people in the Mac world think they're shielded. We talked about that. That's another one that's not necessarily true. Just because you're running a Mac doesn't mean that you're totally secure. And then the pop-up ad that says, hey, you're insecure, click on this. That's a real bad choice. And being careful when shopping online, looking for the little lock symbol that says that you're in a secure connection, or the e-trust is another one. There's different things to look for when you're shopping online. Use a reputable, somebody you've done business with otherwise is a good choice, I think. If you don't never heard of the company and it's an unbelievable offer, you might want to do a little research. Another thing I do a lot is just I'll Google something. I had a weird you get a phone call that says call this number back, you won something. Well, I Googled it. It was a scam. Yeah, Googled the number.
And that presumably is one of the ways that you should check this, is by picking up the phone also and calling and saying. We are talking about consumer cybersecurity here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. My guests are Indiana State Police Lieutenant Chuck Cohen, Scott McElwain of Cadre Information Security, and Evan Thomas of the National Bank of Indianapolis. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, Executive Editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. My guests today, as we talk about consumer cybersecurity, are Indiana State Police Lieutenant Chuck Cohen, Scott McElwain of Cadre Information Security, and Evan Thomas of the National Bank of Indianapolis. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Rick, and I'm hoping I will pronounce the name right. It's, what about the Linux operating system? Did I get that right, Evan Thomas?
You did get that right.
Oh, my goodness.
Linux is more of an enthusiast operating system, so it's got a lot less of the market share than Windows or Mac. But it is as secure or insecure as somebody's behavior. You know, so you can have a lightly used, very secure platform, but if you aren't going to use common sense, you could still be a victim.
Well, that's a theme that we've kept coming back to in this thing. Do people make different assumptions because it's online? You know, for example, I think with any one of us, if I walked up to you, didn't know you, had never introduced myself, we had no knowledge of each other, or you had absolutely no idea about my reputation, I walked up to you and asked you for your Social Security number, presumably none of you would give it to me. Should the same sort of wariness be apparent when you're online? Evan Thomas.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we have an interesting social experiment. I mean, Facebook, text messaging, all these things that leave us physically disconnected, but we think we have a relationship. So I think naturally I've been conversing with someone on email, on Facebook. I feel like I know them. I'm going to start to act like I know them. And in reality, you don't know them. You don't know who they are.
Well, and presumably, I think you've made reference to this, Lieutenant Chuck Cohen of the Indiana State Police, when you've made the argument that the other big area, obviously, of cybersecurity issues is people online trying to take advantage of children. Presumably, they're often not presenting themselves as who they really are, that there are ways to obscure what your identity is online. Are there ways you can attempt to verify if the person you are talking to is actually the person he or she says she is? I got lost in that sentence, but I think I came out all right.
When we talk about attribution of identity, knowing who someone is online, that's one of the biggest challenges in the cybersecurity world, is how do we have that position of trust where I know what business I'm actually dealing with, where I know when I click something on a website that that's actually where I'm going to be going to. Particularly when it's not a bricks and mortar or physical business I'm doing business with, particularly it's not when it's a friend in real life or FIRL. That's why when we talk about children, as you mentioned, one of the biggest pieces of advice that we give to parents is we don't tell parents, don't let your child do online social networking. Mm-hmm. But one of the big pieces of advice that I personally give is if your child is going to have friends on social networking, have those be friends in real life, someone that you or your child has at least set eyes on, so you can do that attribution of identity, so you can know who that person is in the real world. And that holds true for adults as well. If you're going to be giving your personal information to a business or person, do you know who that business or person really is in the real world?
We've gotten a question from a listener named Mary who says, how do criminals get credit card numbers? What are the ways they use to do that? I'm going to toss that one first to Lieutenant Cohen and then to Scott McElwain.
Well, one of the ways is they exploit databases held by companies. So one of the things you can do to protect yourself from having your credit card number exploited, and most of your listeners have probably had the experience where one of your credit card or debit card providers has said that they need to give you a new credit card number. Mm-hmm. Likely that's because your credit card number was among millions that was exploited in some database someplace. So many credit card providers and debit card providers now allow you to have one-use-only numbers you can use for online activities. Or if they don't, use a service like PayPal, where PayPal knows your credit card, so limit the number of places that your credit card number is known and being held around the world.
And Scott McElwain.
Yeah, the credit card industry, they do, a relatively good job. There's a standard called PCI, Payment Card Industry Security Standard, PCI DSS, Data Security Standard, that provides worldwide standards that credit card companies need to adhere to in order to offer their services. And it does do generally a good job. Most of the providers of credit cards adhere to those standards, and it does work. It's usually the human element that causes failure in the whole thing. One example, I mean, you go to a restaurant and you give your credit card to the server, and they go back somewhere to run it. Now, what are they doing with that card? They can be copying the number. They can be. It's not likely, but those, you know, things like that. You're always out there in the world with these things, and you need to be, you know, both in the technology world and in the human world, aware of what's going on with your important information.
Evan Thomas.
You can actually buy all these exposed credit card numbers from a couple of places on the internet if you speak and read Russian. But what tends to happen is you'll have somebody in not a credit card company, but in a merchant, not use their common sense and change their default router password. One of the biggest exposures was a major retailer who used a wireless network inside their business, and they left the administrator password 1234, and somebody in a van in the parking lot just started watching all the traffic on their network and grabbed millions of credit card numbers. And then the bad guys sell those off, and those aren't necessarily exploited immediately, but they're doled out over the internet over a period of months or years. So
you may not know for quite a while whether your information has been exploited. And then, of course, I would assume, Lieutenant Cohen, that makes it difficult also to trace it back and figure out how it happened.
Well, it makes it extremely difficult. The online retailer that he mentioned actually lost 135 million credit card numbers and has stores throughout Indiana. But one of the biggest challenges from an investigative standpoint is there really is no such thing anymore as a local crime. There always are things of evidentiary value leads to follow that fall outside the jurisdiction, outside the area of responsibility for any police department, including large federal police departments. Because, as you mentioned, the credit card numbers, your credit card number goes for between $2 and $5, assuming that it's in pristine condition. So your identity is, frankly, not very valuable once it's been exploited and will be used by a number of people throughout the world.
And you're right about that. I know of someone whose credit card number got grabbed, they don't quite know how, and suddenly the tip-off was they saw in their statement that they'd started buying tickets to I think, University of Southern Mississippi football games or something like that. Evan Thomas.
And the best way to protect yourself against that fraud, whether it's someone has hacked into your internet account or, you know, maybe bought a credit card number, is read your statement.
Yeah.
You know, common sense.
Reconcile.
Watch for those transactions.
Yeah, reconcile
exactly.
It and make sure. We are talking about consumer cybersecurity here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Carl, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'm hoping to be able to ask a question, make a statement. My question is, with the requirements in people's daily lives of having multiple passwords for different systems, whether they are work-related, personal-related, my question is to your guests, what is the scheme or mechanism they recommend to manage multiple types of passwords and the different requirements for the password? This password requires first letter B, an alphabet, and alphanumeric only, exclamation or special characters, things like that. What do you recommend?
Well, thank you very much. I think I'm going to let them take the question because we're getting a little bit tight on time. Thanks for the call, Carl.
Okay.
And what ways, Scott McElwain, would you recommend?
Well, having a routine that you use that you keep consistent, but it does produce different passwords. And there are services I'm not going to recommend. I don't have one I recommend, but there's ones that you can pay. They're relatively inexpensive, but they're services that you load, especially in the smartphone world. I know in the Android and in the iPhone world, that allow you to keep your passwords in those in a secure way, that obviously you have a password protecting those one, but it keeps all these different passwords, all the different ways that they want you to structure those passwords so you can keep track of it. I know personally, you know, as you get into more and more things, I mean, I even referee soccer and there's it's all online and there's passwords with that. It seems like there's nothing that doesn't require you anymore to have that password. So it is a challenge, but purchasing one of the password management, one of the well-known ones, I think, is a good choice to help with that.
Well, and we've gotten a question that's sort of on point here, an email question from a listener named Tim, who says, I understand the need to create, maintain, and periodically change passwords for different accounts, but how does one manage the passwords, especially if one has occasional memory problems? Also, every bill I pay these days requests I set up an account online to manage, which is a good idea to save paper, etc., but that is one more password. Advice? Is it just the price of working online? Thanks, Tim. Evan Thomas, I think that's probably directed toward your wheelhouse the most.
So, from my perspective, back to the previous question, mm-hmm. you come up with a password scheme that works. I think the most prevalent one currently is we ask people to think of a sentence or a song lyric and take the first letter out of each word in the sentence or each word in the song lyric. And if you can remember the song lyric, you can remember the password. And with maybe a couple of tweaks, you can make it meet whatever those capitalization and special character requirements are. But anytime one trick gets really common, the bad guys figure that out and figure out a way to hack that trick, so you got to come up with a new trick. So really, from my perspective, great passwords aren't all that important. Changing them is important. So you can have sort of a lousy password, but if you change it regularly, it's only lousy for 30 days, it's only lousy for 90 days. I would much rather have you change it frequently. As far as having multiple online passwords with multiple online vendors, again, if you change them, I don't think you have a huge exposure. If you have the same password that you put in place in 2008 on all your utility companies, and it's on Facebook, and it's on PayPal, that's when we start to get a little worried.
How often, one of the themes here is that you should change it pretty frequently. How often would you recommend, Lieutenant Chuck Cohen of the Indiana State Police, how often should someone change his or her password?
Some people say 30 days, some people say 90. One good thing you can do is whenever you change your furnace filter, change all your passwords. It is complicated. There are lots of responsibilities doing things online. But same thing as homeownership. You change your furnace filter. You lock the door before you leave. You make sure the windows are closed. You set the thermostat. You turn the lights off. The same thing when you're doing things online. You follow all those kind of things, and you have them become patterns and part of your life so that you make yourself as least likely as possible to become a victim and also have a smaller footprint as possible in various financial places so you can't be exploited.
When we're talking about all of this, we've focused on the passwords and the behaviors. Are there times that you should update the technology too? And we've talked about the updates in terms of some of the software and all of that. Should you update the hardware periodically too, Scott McElwain?
I think that usually comes into is it meeting the performance expectations of what you expect more? It's the operating system and the software you're running that'll be the threats generally to you being hacked. But that comes into preference as far as what kind of performance are you expecting. And generally, it seems, I know I have one old PC at home that it barely does anything. It just seems like over time they become loaded with just things that happen in the background that slow that system down, and that's usually when people will have a desire to upgrade it. Of course, the manufacturers are all selling the latest mm-hmm. and greatest, and here's the better screen, the faster processors, the more memory, those type of things that they are trying to obviously encourage you to upgrade as soon as possible. It's really personal as far as what is it meeting your needs, is it doing what you want, and then
But there's not necessarily a security concern, I guess is where I'm going.
Generally, I would say no. I mean, there's things they do to the newer things in the network cards and such that make them more secure, but you have something.
Evan Thomas is bouncing his head back and forth too with a yes and no. So give me the yes on that.
So you might have a Windows XP machine running at home, and that operating system is 12 years old? I mean, I don't know. It's been around for a while, and it's not that uncommon. And I think you can make that operating system and hardware running that operating system very secure. I think if you had a machine that was so old it would only run Windows 98, you probably couldn't get that modern, up-to-date, secure browser. So, I mean, eventually, you probably need new hardware, but that's a long time. Most people will be frustrated before we get to that point.
And what should you do with old computers? Also, the reason I asked this, at a not-for-profit I worked at a few years ago, there were some people who wanted to donate their old system to us and then realized, oops, no, that's not a good idea. There are security concerns. We actually have to destroy them all. Evan Thomas.
There is a federal criteria for data shredding, and you can, for not very much money, go to your local retailer or download a data shredding piece of software that will scrub your hard drive and write zeros and ones over it, and then you can recycle it or donate it without worry of your data getting out.
Well, in terms of the practical steps someone could take right now, if they want to go home and, or, you know, just pull out their smartphone and determine whether they've done anything stupid, what steps should they take at this moment, Lieutenant Chuck Cohen?
Well, the first thing, as we've said several times, go home and change all your passwords. Make sure it's a strong password, meaning something that is not easily guessed, not something not out of a dictionary, something that's not really tied to your address or your personal life. Go to your tablet or your phone. And while it's more convenient for those apps many times to leave them logged in, go ahead and log off those. Most people have a Facebook profile now. It's sort of ubiquitous. Go into Facebook, go into the account settings at the top right of the screen, and see how many sessions you're currently logged into. If you've never checked before, most people logged in at least 5 or 6 different places just because at some point they, instead of logging out of Facebook, they just close the browser, hit the little X button in the top right of the screen, so they're still logged in someplace they don't realize they are, and that's something that can make you vulnerable to certain types of exploitation.
So, and that's a basic, Scott McElwain, that sounds like a pretty basic tip. When you go someplace, make sure you log out.
Sure, always right. Before closing the browser, it's always a good choice to log out, exit the application as that application dictates.
And Evan Thomas, I'm going to give you the last word here in this conversation. What's one step people could do to make themselves a little bit safer?
Put a password on your smartphone, so if you leave it on the table at lunch, people don't have the keys to your kingdom.
And can't come in and just pick up all of your information and all of that. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank all of my guests for joining us today. And they would be Indiana State Police Lieutenant Chuck Cohen. Lieutenant Cohen, thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Certainly. And Scott McElwain of Cadre Information Security. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Evan Thomas of the National Bank of Indianapolis, thank you for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We are going to be back next week when we're going to be talking about local redevelopment. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Have a good week.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Public Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alsif. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at 1 p.m. for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.